if you look carefully, this is in the Bugaboos again, to give you an idea of the scale of some of these peaks. These are tracks over here of people that were walking and sliding down. And there were a fair amount of people. There must have been 20 or 30 people over there that day. So these are big spires. And they attract a lot of attention from climbers, and unfortunately they're also great shots for lightning. I've gone to places like this is on Vancouver Island. This is where I got scared last summer. It's a big wall located right out of the rainforest. And they call this Landslide Lake, something like that. You can see a bunch of rock over here. There was a big rock slide here that actually started right here off the spire. Came into the lake, flooded the lake completely down the valley. and you get kind of humbled standing there looking up at that. We looked at this wall and we turned around and went home. it was really scary looking to me. But you did get to see some fantastic sights. This was we planned to spend a night near the summit of this peak. This wild rock on the right is called Sherpa Balanced Rock. It's looks like a rocket ready to take off. And we were watching cars down on I-90 about 15, 20 miles away going by. You see things like this. This is Berg Lake at the base of the north face of Mount Robson. The wall on the right is the biggest wall in the Canadian Rockies. To give you an idea of the scale, the nose of El Capitan, which is about close to 3,000 feet high, is about the same distance as from the summit to here. And this is the north face of Robson. It's 9,000 feet approximately from the lake to the north face, with these glaciers that come down to below 5,000 feet. There's a wonderful trail going in there. I've never climbed the mountain. I tried a couple years ago and I probably won't. But the hike in there is one of the most fantastic walks I've ever taken in my life. And there are no Americans on it. It was all Europeans and Japanese and some Koreans, but very few people speaking English on the trail.
What's the altitude of Robson?
12 something, 12.8, 12.9, something like that.
It's not as high as Rainier.
No, but the bases are. Robson is a difficult mountain, very difficult mountain. You get up in the morning and you see some interesting things. I do want to credit my friend in Seattle, Dave Schiffelbein. Dave took quite a few of these photos. He's a professional wilderness photographer that I've had the pleasure of climbing with, so he's gotten my picture published in a few places. And it's kind of fun. If you want some wilderness photography and you live in Seattle, he's really the guy to see. They're skiing in the mountains. Holden offers wonderful ski touring opportunities in the winter. I was a hack when I skied out here, and I basically spent a lot of time on the ground. It's very interesting. You ski up the valley here, up the Railroad Creek Trail. It's good skiing, and it tends to get beat down by the Holden skiers, but there's some springs up on the north side of the trail, and they flow all winter, and they melt the snow away. And there's one particular spring that you have to ski over the trail bridge to get over it. And the trail bridge allows you about a 2 foot wide track to ski on, and it's at the bottom of a hill. And I was coming down that hill once with about a 40 pound pack on, and it's right at a turn. And I got to the bridge with one ski on the bridge, and I knew this was going to be very interesting all of a sudden. And there was a 6 foot trench leading down to the creek because there was that much snow on the ground. And I was alone, which I was kind of glad about because I went head first into this trench. And with my pack on, I was totally pinned upside down with my skis kind of sticking out above. And I had to unstrap my pack. My poles were jammed in everywhere. I got the wrist straps off. I had to reach up and pick my skis off. And about a half an hour later, I got out of there. It was just a struggle the whole time.
Really wet.
Well, I knocked enough snow in with me where I never even really got wet from it. It kind of filled it up enough where I didn't get too wet. But it was pretty funny, all in all. I want to talk a little bit about some of the ocean beaches in Washington. There's some fabulous wilderness beaches. That's not a bottle brush there. That's my wife's head after being out for a few days. The hair gets a little bit. I tell her I say these things when I get home afterwards. So she understands. She's a real good hiker. She's an excellent skier. She climbed for a while. She had an accident in the Tetons, and I ended up in the hospital with her in Jackson with a concussion, and that was kind of a scary experience and kind of took the wind out of her sails there. And then we'll talk a little bit more about hiking today. This happens to be in Minnesota, just to prove that there is some nice hiking in Minnesota. Get out and do it. The fall colors can be fantastic. We were on a 5 mile hike here around the lake in Teduguch State Park, if you've ever been here, northern Minnesota, one of my favorite places. So hiking can be found anywhere. It doesn't have to be in the high mountains. Glacier National Park, one of my most humorous experiences was up here. We were coming up to this pass, and there was a man and a woman running down the trail going, "Grizzly bear, grizzly bear!" And they were taking off running, and we just kind of said, okay. And we got up a little higher, and we found their backpack sitting on the ground. And then a minute later, there's another guy up there going, "Oh, where's the bear?" Or, no, they said bear. They didn't say grizzly bear. And then the guy came up and said, "Where's the grizz? I want to see the grizz." And we didn't have a clue what they were talking about. And finally, the people came back, and they showed us what they thought was a grizzly bear. And we looked through our binoculars, and they had binoculars, and what they saw were marmots. So we assured them that things were okay here.
Is she holding?
She's got an ice axe in her hand there. They're used for climbing snow and ice, and we brought them along because when you're hiking in snowy conditions like this, if you have to cross a steep snow slope, there's something called ice axe at rest, where if you get sliding down the snow by accident, you can actually roll onto your ice axe and stop yourself. And if you're going to travel on steep snow, you need to have an ice axe for safe travel. So my wife and I both know how to use them, and it's got a, you can see the sharp, it's a cutting tool. You know, you got a sharp points here, here, and here, and they kill a fair amount of people every year. When they don't know how to use them, they fall on the sharp end. One guy died on Bonanza some years ago when he fell on his. I think there was a person that got one in the leg up at Lyman Lake once and had to be helicoptered out of there. But they make snow travel real safe. Well, safer. It's really great fun. We go up on the tailings and practice it. And when you're really good, you go up on real steep snow, and we would jump onto our backs, so you're sliding head first on your back. And there's actually a technique where you plant it next to you and you swing your body around, and it all happens real fast if you do it right. But you need to do that. I was on coming off a peak one time, and my feet came out on the snow slope. And I immediately went into self-arrest, and you end up on top of your ice axe with your butt up in the air, and you're digging in your toes, and you're just fighting it all. And when I stopped, I kind of looked between my legs, and right between my feet was about a foot in diameter rock sitting in the snow. And I stopped just in time from hitting that rock. So you want to hit it right now if you start to fall. I love mountain springs. We used to drink freely out of most streams in the Cascades. Now I tend to treat my water wherever I go with a pump with iodine. I've only had Giardia twice. You'd think I would have learned the first time. It's a great way to lose weight. I don't really recommend it. I lost 15 pounds in about 2 weeks because you're not hungry, so you don't eat, and then you do eat, and your insides aren't nice to you after you do that. So you basically lose all the food you just ate. So I went 2 weeks without keeping anything in, and I finally went to the doctor, and they got rid of it right away. But it's treat your water even around here. It's not worth the
disease. What did you use to treat the water?
They've got these pumps now with filters in them. I tend to use that. You can get these little iodine pills as well, which will kill Giardia.
Iodine pills.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's other neat things in the water. We were camped high in a mountain last year, and the only water nearby was a little drip, and there's a little vegetation there. So we had a cardboard box with us. We cut it open, made a little funnel out of it. And we hadn't had water for hours. We were really dehydrated, and we filled up our water bottle with the funnel. And we both drank a bottle down. We filled them up again. It was getting dark at this time. Filled them up again, drank about half the bottle, filled them up to the top, and the next day we didn't drink that much, and we descended on down the mountain, and we got off the peak, and we stopped under some trees. And I took a drink of the bottle, and I happened to glance in there, and there are all these worms swimming on the bottom of the bottle. And apparently they didn't do any harm to me. But watch what you drink. It's
protein, Jim.
Pardon?
Protein.
That's what protein drink. Yeah, sports drink there. Most of the people, when I take these photos, I don't ask them to smile. They're just kind of doing it, you know, all the time there. It's exciting and fun. I'm standing on top of Martin Ridge. I don't know if he's smiling because of the view or because he knows he only's got about 5 more feet to go to get to the top. Some places go through a lot of trouble for hiking. This is in Mount Robson National Park. I don't know how the early pioneers got across this creek, but I sure like the swinging bridges that we went across when we were hiking in there. It's just a beautiful area and very well-maintained trails up there. Sometimes there's a little snow. Millam Pass, I think the sign was 5 or 6 feet off the ground. And there was a little bit of snow when we were up there. So. I'm going to skip that one real quick. On the Cascades, you will be camping and traveling on snow quite a bit. And in the summers, it's hot. You got to look out for sunburn. It's a major problem. My wife had shorts and a t-shirt on, and we were just gooped up with sun stuff as we went up. This is the Spider Glacier over by Lyman Lake, above Lyman Lake. Just an early morning glacial bowl somewhere. Cornices are a problem. You have to really skirt them with care. You don't want them to break underneath you. This is just going over trail pass, which in the summer is no big deal, but in the spring there is quite a bit of snow in the area, and we couldn't find the trail anyway, so we just had to wind our way through there. You get to wear some kind of funny looking clothes when you're doing this sport. And when you're out in the middle of nowhere, you know, it really doesn't matter what you have on. Warm underwear. This guy happens to be a concert harpsichordist and was a former cook at Holden for a couple years. And I haven't seen him for a while, but he knows I show the slide. Trails can be discouraging sometimes. We looked back at this after we got to the top and kind of went, wow. No wonder we were sweating coming up that. Slow and easy for me is the way to go. It's more fun, less hard on the body, and you can enjoy the views more. Even just hiking, you can get to some high points. This is Ruth Mountain up in the North Cascades that are just gorgeous. Terry and I have hiked together for years. She's a great partner. We haven't done as much lately because of two reasons, Mike and Hannah, and I miss that. We hope to do it again as the kids get a little older. Camping on snow is a reality in the Cascades most of the time. We'll often bring a tent along. He's not starting a forest fire. A lot of these backpacking stoves, you have to let them flare up a little bit before they work very well. And that's standard operating procedure to get them started.
It's a little farther away from the tent than it actually looks.
Actually, probably not. It was getting cold. And on this particular time was the middle of winter, and it was 25 below that night, and we got our bottles stuck in the snow there. Everything was freezing up on us. It was pretty nasty cold that night. And we kind of wanted to sit in the tent and eat dinner. But usually they should be farther away. In the summers, you can camp almost anywhere in wilderness areas, keeping in mind lakes and things like that do suffer pollution, especially from human use. You should bury your human waste, you know, at least a couple hundred feet away from lakes. That's a major source of Giardia, is what the humans do. Sometimes we'll cut ledges out of the rock and snow and put our tent up. That's what we did. This was the day after my wife thought she was going to die. We hiked up in this pass and put our tent up there. Some places in Canada in particular have a pretty nice hut system. This is the $2 a night place near the base of Mount Assiniboine, and it's run by BC Parks. And if you're a little deeper in the pockets, you can stay at the $120 a night place, which is across the valley, and most of the people here helicopter in. Mm-hmm. They can run helicopters 3 or 4 days a week. It's right outside of Banff. And as we didn't stay there, but they serve high tea every day for $5. It's all the tea you can drink and all the little treats that go with it. We ate about $10 worth, I think. It's a gorgeous place. And as you look out of the front, this is what you see from the lodge. And this is Mount Assiniboine in the Canadian Rockies. So you don't have to haul all this garbage around. There's my dream when the kids are older is to spend New Year's up at this place and ski this bowl. And we may be retired when we do it, but I'm going to do it someday. Sometimes you don't bring any tent at all, and you spend the night out what's called bivouac. My partner here has got a sleeping bag inside of this Gore-Tex sack, and we're spending the night just in this location. You can see Mount Rainier in the background out there. This is in the Stewart Range over above Leavenworth.
Have you ever slept on one of those things that hangs out over the edge?
Like the portal edge type things? I have, and I'm not. The idea of spending 3 or 4 or 10 days on a big wall is really boring to me, even though it's quite steep. So I haven't. No, I'm not a gearhead, I think you have to be a gearhead in those kind of climbs. You got to enjoy fiddling with stuff, and you have pitches that. You know, 150-foot section of rock that might take 8 hours to climb, sort of thing. I'm not into that at all. I like to be on the ground. This is Bonanza Peak again, a couple of views down of Holden Lake. And I'm going to quickly run through the lakes in the area, Heart Lake. This is interesting. You can see something here that's changed over the years. You can see the dust cloud from the tailings back here starting to go up. It used to blow up to about 10,000 feet. Wow. And it was a major source of air and water pollution. And they put I don't know how many tons of crushed rock on top of the tailings. I think it was about 8 or 9, 10 years ago now. And it's really stabilized the dust that's blowing from the tailings. But it used to be quite the health hazard up here. They had a design so most of it blew down the valley, but you could see that dust plume from everywhere blowing off the tailings. It's kind of like a fine talcum powdery dust. Holden or Heart Lake from the switchbacks near Lyman. And then you get up to Lyman, which is, again, just a gorgeous area. If you get a chance and can manage it, it's really worth the hike up there. You go up above Lyman, and you start seeing some fantastic things opening up. This is looking back down the valley. That's Bonanza Peak right there. Not a real good weather day. As you get higher above the lake towards Cloudy Pass, you look back down towards Lyman, and you just... Cloudy Pass is a fantastic area. It's just beautiful up there. We were on snow this whole time. You start seeing Glacier Peak finally as you get near the pass. It picks up its head. It's fourth highest peak in Washington. And as you get higher, the Seattle River Valley curves around Glacier Peak and it gives you some pretty magnificent vistas of the mountain. Lovely area. Deep holes again. Down there. Copper Basin, which is loaded with mosquitoes right now. It's a pretty good grunt to get up there. It's a good 2,300 feet to get up there in about 3 miles, so the trail doesn't mess around. It never goes down, really, until you get to the basin. Then it goes down about 100 feet and keep thinking, I don't want to come back up this when I leave. But you have to. Oh, yeah, Eric. That's why you got to go in the fall with the early snows. The bugs aren't bad, and the new snows can be quite pretty. Donkey Lake, down above Lake Chelan, there used to be a guy named Gordon Stewart that lived down there. I had the pleasure of meeting him some years ago. He was a hermit that lived there for, I don't know, 50, 60 years or something. They got his history in the bookstore over here. Interesting guy. He was very learned. When I would talk to him, he knew what was going on in the world, and was quite the guy. I was impressed by him.
How'd they get the name Donkey Lake, do you know?
I don't know. It's D-O-M-K-E.
Oh, Donkey.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what that name came from. The Lakeshore Trail on the other side of Lake Chelan is a wonderful hike. We got tired of being in the snow. We bailed out of a trip early and walked the Lakeshore Trail one time. Just nice to be in the sun. Rattlesnakes you gotta look out for. Back along the beach, there's some Wilderness Beach in Washington. The thing you have to watch for here are the tides. We went through here at high tide, we had to take a trail around the head. And when it came through at low tide, we just walked right through this tunnel. And it's just beautiful ocean beaches, big trees. This particular part of beach was protected by heads on either side. And some people were camping here with us. And in the morning, the tide was low, so they all left. And Terry and I decided to spend another night here. Then the tides came back up, and nobody could get in there. We had this beach all to ourselves all day, and the tides went out, and some people hiked in and put their tents up by us again. Really fantastic. You can... did I go the wrong way? Let's see. You run into some interesting things on the whale, or on the beach. There were two dead whales in this section. Very close together, and I think most of the flies from Western Washington were on them at the time. It was kind of sad to see, but I guess it's part of life out there. It's, when you see an animal this huge, it's kind of amazing. We had to walk right next to them too. There's no getting around them. There's a sport called telemark skiing. It's downhill skiing on cross-country skis, and my wife thinks she's a hot shot here, and she's pretty graceful. I've got quite a few pictures of her. This is actually end of July in Wyoming. It was tough at home in Minnesota. It was about 90 degrees and humid, and I'm packing skis and warm clothing. And it's like, should we bring our hats and gloves and all that? We do, because we know it gets cold. But the snow is in nice spring conditions here, and we had to walk 15 miles in there with our skis before we could ski. Mount Rainier and the Cascades do offer some fine skiing. This happens to be above Paradise. You can see Adams in the background there in the Tatoosh Range in Frenia. This was just a November day where it was clear and cold and Minnesota snow, which you don't see in Washington. the Tetons in winter. I made an ill-fated attempt to climb the Grand one year in winter. I went out there and didn't see much. The snows I was in my tent for 6 days alone. Let's put it that way. It was very boring. Back to the skiing again. We'd often find these flat spots under trees and kind of tree wells to set up camp or to just kind of relax a little bit and eat some lunch. There's a place called Big Creek Basin, which is the next valley over past Copper Peak. There's no trail, and it's awful in the summer, to say the least. In the winter, they like you to ski out with four people. My wife and I just wanted to get away, so I knew the way up Big Creek because I'd done it in the summer, and I said, let's go ski this. It'll be wonderful. We got up to the basin up there, and it was just really pretty. And we skied out, didn't tell anybody in the village except one or two people where we had gone. About 5 days later, beautiful weather, a large group decided they were going to be the first to penetrate the Big Creek Valley. They went around Copper Peak, they got cliff, they had a heck of a time, but they were really proud when they got up to the basin, and then they found our ski tracks. And it took them about a week to figure out who had been up there. It was kind of funny. It's a beautiful valley, and the skiing was just superb. I was just learning to downhill ski on cross-country skis, and my wife was pretty good at it, so she'd do 5 or 6 turns down the hill there, and then she'd stop because she wanted a good laugh. You know, she'd watch me until I'd be face first in the snow, and then, you know, while I'm picking myself up, she'd ski down some more. And it was quite humbling, actually. Avalanches are a big problem. I set this one off on Mount Index, and I happen to recognize the conditions just because I studied it a lot, and it paid off that day. We actually walked down the avalanche chute after it slid. We set it off on purpose. We pushed snow into the trigger area, set it off, and we walked down behind it. It was one of those, it was lucky, but I don't know, I called it right. I was really pleased with myself. And there she is skiing again. She's so graceful. You can see her turns behind her there. And this is all on 3-pin stuff. These aren't downhill bindings or anything. It's just a regular cross-country boot. But there she is again. This is on Mount Adams. I wasn't able to ski because I took this major fall and I couldn't use my left arm, so I just kept taking pictures of her on the way down. She'd wait for me, you know. And she falls a lot less than I do. She falls when it's flat. I don't understand it. She'll trip over her own 2 feet and fall, but when it's harder skiing, she usually doesn't fall. And there, you can see this is in summer. There's no snow down low. We're on the Bull Lake glaciers and the Wind Rivers. And this was, again, the day after she was really sick, and she just was skiing fine that day. And then I was trying to do it too, but I'm not half as graceful as she is. This is on Mount Adams. Mount Adams is a great ski. Here's me. And see, she looks graceful. I look like I'm fighting to stay on my skis all the time, and that's probably not deceiving. Okay, the last little section on climbing here. Climbing often looks harder than it is, and this is on Cathedral Peak in the North Cascades. And these are done mostly by my friend Dave in Seattle. You're trying to route find. We're not roped up here yet, which seems kind of foolhardy, but the climbing was actually pretty easy. We got to this 300-foot vertical wall, and my partner doesn't route find real well, so I got the sharp end of the rope and got to go first, and the route was all there, but it was very steep. It wasn't hard, but it was overhanging. I'm climbing with a pack on and hard hats on, and we got ice climbing gear with us, so sometimes the needles of South Dakota are a lot more relaxing than that. This is, you can see here, this guy is clipping into some bolts. He's clipped into one down here, and he's clipped into one right here. And he's tied into the rope right here, and I kind of cheated on some of these shots. I tied him off to a tree so I could let go of the rope, and then I ran around and took his picture. And then
Do you trust other people's clips? Are they already in there, or did you put them in yourself?
We clipped in ourselves, but the bolts are already in the rock.
That's what I mean. You trust those bolts?
Pretty much. Yeah, if they're newer ones, in this kind of granite, they're usually pretty good. Most of the people that put them in kind of know what they're doing. You hear about them failing occasionally, especially in softer rock. That's where you really have to look out. In a hard rock like this, it's usually not that big a deal. So he's trying to look like he's climbing here, but he's not really. He's just posing. And this guy's 48 years old, and he does climb good for an old guy. I tell him that all the time. But when I was out with him last time I was out climbing, I got called sir once or twice by these 17-year-old kids that were climbing, and I haven't heard the end of that one since then. The nice thing about it is I'm a lot harder out than they were, so I felt good about that. I'm placing my own protection in here. I'm starting a crack system. You can see my hands buried up to the the wrist and the crack. And you can see my other hand's all taped up there because the rock is real grainy. There's no footholds to speak of. You either stick your toe in the crack or you do what's called smearing. You just smear your feet on the rock. I bring a pair of tennis shoes along to walk down in because the rock shoes, you buy them like a size too small and they're painful. They hurt real bad. Devil's Tower again, just a fantastic area. It's like sitting on an island in the sky when you're there. I even sat on cactus up there one time. I got up real quick. And it's real funny, I'll climb the tower, but I won't go near the edge when I'm on the top because I know I'm going to trip and fall over. I'm paranoid of doing that. The standard route goes up this column here, the easiest route on the tower, and through this crack system and up through here. It's called the Durance Route. It's a real famous route on the tower. But these are the kind of cracks you tend to follow. And you can see a lot of protection in there. It's hard climbing. Every move is fairly difficult on that. And this crack goes up for 250 feet with no ledges. So you climb 150 feet and you hang there and belay your partner up. And you hang there for probably an hour or so until he climbs the next pitch. And there's no ledges or anything on many of these routes. Here I'm trying to sort out protection before going through an overhang. The climb is real easy, but then it gets real hard. And if I fall, I'm going to end up in that tree down there. So I wanted all the protection I could get. This is not a full-bodied person's type of sport. I mean, I should be playing football rather than climbing, probably. You're supposed to be skinny with real big forearms to do this.
Do you pull those things back out, or do you leave them in there?
In this last one, I would pull these things out. My second would. The guy coming up behind me, the bolts you leave them in. And they're there for the next party. The desert is a fantastic place to climb. This is Castleton Tower outside of Moab, Utah. It's about the size of the IDS building in Minneapolis, about 500-600 feet high. And it offers beautiful views. I never saw the view from the summit because this major storm was moving in and all the sand was blowing. We could barely open our eyes. So when I took this picture and I got it home and developed it, I thought, wow, that's what it looked like up there. Some of it climbs chimney systems where your nose is a couple inches away from the rock and you're squeezing your body in there and trying to wedge stuff in and move up, and it's real interesting. Modern climbers hate routes like that. There's that classic shot again. You're in a corner and it helps to be flexible when you do this sport. That's all the picture kind of says it for itself there. This is what we saw on the summit. This is the best I could do to stand up. And you can look at my raincoat, and I'm totally plastered by the wind. We stayed tied in on the summit because it was blowing so hard. The storm's over my shoulder. We started rappelling down right away, and lightning hit the tower as we finished our last rappel. And we were pinned down by the storm for over an hour with winds that we just couldn't move in. So it was we were really glad to make the summit, but we were really glad to get out of there. Some people climb ice. I don't do much of it anymore because I think it's dangerous. But you use these ice axes and crampons to run up the ice. Hanging out on glaciers is always fun. And you need the same kind of tools as you do for climbing ice. Kind of run through these here. Sometimes we just leave the rope behind and just climb. And this is on the upper part of the Exxon Ridge on the Grand Teton. My partner hadn't climbed on rope very much, and I talked him into doing the last 1,000 feet on rope. It's not real hard. It's like 5.5 or something, if you don't climb or talk. But there's some exposure, and he was pretty excited when we got to the top because we had done it unroped. And he had a good time. I almost killed him on the descent, but we had a good time. And again, the views tend to be outstanding. I think we're about... Oh! Oftentimes now on summits, you'll find registers. A lot of them have been taken. I found this one behind the village on this thing called Black Tower, and this was the first ascent in 1941 by those four people there. So I took a picture of it. My ascent was the fifth ascent of this particular chunk of rock. It wasn't real hard. It just kind of isolated back here. And there's a little tin can up there, and it was attached to a chain to a piton, and there are five ascents in it since 1941. And that's less than 2 hours from the village. This is my ill-fated attempt to climb the Grand Solo in winter. Not a good idea. I had skis, climbing gear. My pack was 60 to 70 pounds. I've never been so bored in my life sitting out the storm that would never end. Matter of fact, I got pulled over for speeding on my way back home, and I talked the cop's ear off because he's the first person I had talked to for days. And he didn't even give me a ticket. He just gave me a warning. I'm glad to stop. But oftentimes you'll get a cloud cap forming over mountains. Rainier gets that all the time. It's usually a sign of an incoming storm. This cloud cap was over the entire range. And this is the day I drove into the valley, and that was the last day I saw the Grand until the next summer when I came back. It was an awful storm.
Say, Jim, when you climb those peaks, do you leave something on the top that lets people know that you were there, or do you just record it when you're down?
If there's a register, I'll sign it. Otherwise, no. You're pretty much on the honor system, It really doesn't make a whole lot of difference in life. And then in the Canadian Rockies again, you get to some interesting places. I think, that's the last slide. Get out there, enjoy the land. It's beautiful around here. Any comments about anything? Yes, sir.
Alternating vaults that are really quite difficult to figure out. Another very strange thing, and something that's the most difficult to figure out, is here's a guy who spent 40 years manufacturing metal window frames, and the windows are just slapped up to the openings, and they're kind of caulked around the edges, and there are these little metal clips that hold them onto the walls. Okay, I can tell none of you are impressed yet. Here's the plan of the building. Here's the sanctuary. And here's the vestry and the, what do you call all those other rooms? The choir and the, the offices are right here. Here's the council chamber. These are like confirmation rooms. Here's the big kind of meeting room that's used for all kinds of church activities. And so what Leverance has done is he's taken the church itself and then surrounded it with the other activities. The wind comes from this side, and so it creates this almost like a little interior street that separates the day-to-day activities of the church from the actual worship space.
You have to go outside.
Yeah, you have to go outside. I don't think there's that much moving back and forth. You know, usually when you go to the church, the only time I can think of is after church you go to coffee hour. I suppose they have coffee hour here, but you know, more often than not, you're either going to confirmation or some class, or you're going to the church. The church, the sanctuary is square in plan. Here's the altar, there's the pulpit, here's the organ. You enter actually this way. This is really the narthex. And there's a little wedding chapel right here. Here's a little waiting room, so that I guess this is where the bride waits when the wedding is going to occur. But the little wedding chapel becomes part of the narthex, and you move into the building this way. One of the remnants of the Church of the Resurrection is the circulation through the building, because again, you come into the back of the church, you face the altar, you come down to the altar, but when church is over, it opens again from the back, and you move out into the garden, out into the park beyond. And you'll see the kind of analogy to the tomb and death and resurrection is equally present in this building. So here we are looking down between the space between the sort of social part of the building and the church itself, and there are those very strange brick chimneys that you can't figure out what the heck they are. Let me go back a sec. So you enter through the narthex. Here's the little wedding chapel. You can see the little door that leads to the waiting room, and the first thing that you notice is that everything is made of brick. And you finally find the door, and what first strikes you is you can't see a thing. It's amazingly dark in there. There are four windows. You can see all four of them here. And so you have to stop. You wouldn't have to stop, but you want to stop. And just wait until your eyes get used to the dark. And as your eyes get used to the other thing that's a little bit disconcerting is that the floor isn't flat. The floor starts to slowly slope down towards the altar there. You can see the altar there. But when you come in, there's also this funny wave in the floor. And so it creates this almost a necessity to just pause and try and figure out where you are and where you should go and not run into anybody else. And as you get acclimatized, this is what you begin to see. And the first thing that you confront, as in many traditional churches, is the baptismal font. But this is not your ordinary run-of-the-mill baptismal font. What it is a gash in the floor. And over that gash is this little steel framework that holds a gigantic clamshell. And here you can see, probably even more clearly in this picture, there's a little spigot that comes up and drops down. And if there aren't a lot of people in this room, as there weren't when I came in here, all you hear is the dripping of water. Because the water drips into the clamshell, but that's not really what you hear. What you really hear is that from the lowest scallop of the shell, the water drips down into this chasm, and there's water down in there. And so you can imagine the walls are brick, the ceiling is brick, the floor is brick. It's a very resonating space. And all you hear is this drip, 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 and it just echoes throughout the room. You get acclimated to the space, and you begin to understand your orientation. I want to show you a little bit about what a perfectionist that Leverance was. You saw here the arrangement of the chairs, and they looked as though they might be somewhat random, that they were just placed there to sort of vaguely orient towards the altar, and that you could move them around at will. Well, they certainly are independent chairs, but if you look carefully at the brickwork, you'll see that laid out in the brickwork is where the chairs should go. I'll talk a minute about the way the bricks are handled, but look at this detail right here, too, the way that the edge of that chasm doesn't end neatly, but all of these little bricks stick out. And here, finally, is the altar itself. The first church that Leverance did in Stockholm was a basilica plan, meaning that it was narrower than it was long. It was more like a traditional church plan. And it had vaults that were similar to these. I'll talk about those in a second. When he decided to go with the square plan, he could no longer span the full distance because this square is 60 feet on a side. And so he had to come up with a way of supporting these vaults in the center of the space. And what he finally ended up doing was deciding to support the vaults in two locations on two long beams, and then those are held up by a single column with a cross beam that picks up the two longer beams. It comes down right in the middle of the church. Actually, not exactly in the middle. Nothing is in the middle in this church. Even where the column comes down, if you look at the two arms of this beam, this one is actually much longer. Significantly longer than the other. So everything is a little bit off. So let me talk about some of the ideas that were present in this building. And this is a building that from a construction level is about brick. There are three things that happen. First of all, everything is made of brick. Second of all, only a normal standard brick is used. And third, no brick is cut. That's why all the bricks jut out at that baptismal font, and that's why here, where there's a pier between windows, you can see here what that causes sometimes in the brickwork. There's a jagged edge because they're not going to fill it in with a partial brick. What Leverance really wanted to do was almost say there's this brick building and anything that you need to use to make it habitable is attached. And so the windows are just slapped on pieces of glass on the outside. The effect that this has, I think you saw in the earlier slides, it's almost like there aren't any windows there. You don't see any front. So from the outside it looks kind of yuck. What in the world is going on here? This is a building that's built from the inside out. from the outside, from the inside, there's no glass. It's just a punched hole through this brick wall. I think it makes the sense of the brick even stronger. The heating is actually run through the brick walls as well, and so what this is a heating duct. This is actually in the social room. In the church sanctuary itself, those walls are solid. There's no space, and so you really get the sense of this 2-foot-thick solid wall that has these windows punched through it. And so when he wanted to do a door, you can see the door detail on the slide on the right. It's not in the middle of the opening. It's almost as though it's just slapped onto the outside of the opening, very similar to the glass. The roof is one of the most interesting and complex parts of the building, and so this is a really good, these are two good slides to show what's happening. This is a model that was built early on, and then this is a little drawing. This is a worm's eye view. So imagine that you're lying on the floor of the sanctuary looking up at the roof. And you can see the central column, the cross beam, picking up the two big beams that run across the length of the sanctuary. And from those two beams are little posts that pick up this extraordinary vaulting structure. There's a piece of steel at the springing point of the vault and at the top of the vault, and then the brick arches are laid in between. But in order to create a sense of rhythm and movement in this space, the vaults aren't the same width down the length of the chapel, but they actually get narrower and wider, and then the next one gets wider and narrower. And we'll get back to slides of the inside, though, but it just creates this fabulous, amazing rhythm on the inside. What happens, though, is that at its widest, then the vault is a pure arch. But because the curvature remains the same, when the vault gets smaller, it almost becomes like a Gothic arch. It almost becomes like a pointed arch. And that's why when you looked at the end of the building, you saw a curved arch and then a shorter pointed arch, because of the geometry of the way the vaults work. And so here, this is really nice too, because you can see the top of the sanctuary partially lifted off, and you can see the shape of the vaults and the way that works. The windows changed. So here it is again, the inside of the sanctuary. I apologize, there's a little too much light coming in. Hey, Sony? Noah, can you close that blind right there? I really think that this building, there's the strongest experience of being underground of any building I've ever been in. You get the most extraordinary sense that all of the steel framework is shoring in a mine or shoring in a cave. And those funny brick stacks that you saw from the outside are actually shafts of light. So there's a brick stack that's built up about 6 feet, and then there's a piece of glass slapped on top of it. And the effect that it has on the inside, and you can see the way that those shafts sit. Here's one of those. You look up the shafts, and what you see is 6 feet of brick. So there's nothing. There's no feeling stronger than the fact that it's not just brick vaults up there. It's solid mass, that you're really inside a cave. So the comparison to a tomb, you know, actually dying, or the other one I think is actually the notion of the early Christians worshiping in the catacombs of Rome. I think that there's also an element of that in there. But the light is very stark and strong. It comes shooting through these shafts. These shafts actually line up with the route that the clergy take from the sacristy. They've got a little door there out to the altar. And then here we're looking back towards the way the parishioners enter, and then you can see the strength, the sort of blinding light of those two windows.
Is there artificial light?
There's artificial light. As a matter of fact, you can see it. Now this is coming from the two side windows, but you can see the artificial light here, but that's kept fairly dim too. So here it is. As I said, the reason the you can look at this building strictly from a construction point of view and say, well, Leverance had done these vaults before in an earlier church. Here he was doing it square, so he had to pick them up somehow. He decided to put a column in the middle. But any of you who sort of are aware of Christian theology or understand symbolism at all can realize the power of this cross right in the middle of the congregation. So a lot of the references that I read also refer to it as the tree of knowledge, but I can't really see the tree of knowledge there. All I can really see is that it's the cross of the crucifixion. And there's this whole notion of being in the midst of the congregation, not up. There is a cross up here somewhere, or maybe there isn't. But right in the middle of the congregation is not only this thing that's holding up the whole building, but it's the cross that sits there and is sort of this amazingly powerful presence in the space. So finally, when the service ends, the back doors open, there they are, and again, it's this notion of coming back out into the garden. So death and rebirth, death and resurrection, I think are major themes in this church. So there you can see, I think this is one of the most clearest images of the vault, and so as you sit there, you begin to understand the space more clearly. I think that the kind of music that would probably be the most suitable for this kind of space would be some kind of Gregorian chant, because I suspect it has a long resonating period. It would be hard to sing something that had a lot of syllables and that was very crisp because of the nature of the space. But in any case, there it is, and you go out into the garden again.
It looks very stark and cold.
It's,
does the warmth of the wood chairs relieve it?
It's not cold. It's the most powerful space I've ever been in, frankly. And so anyway, here's my last slide. The little baptismal font. One of the things that I really like about this is the way the brick is treated right here. That kind of allows that little cross to occur. And here he is, the 80-some-year-old man on the site. The story goes that he spent almost, he was at the site almost continuously, and that in order to get the quality of brick that he wanted, which was very rude and crude, that he wouldn't let the masons use either a plumb line or any kind of a level to lay the brick. So, and they thought he was absolutely crazy, and you might too, but in any case, this is it. And as I said, yeah, it's not cold at all. It's extraordinarily powerful. So that's all I have to show you. Does anyone have any questions about this or?
What's the religion of the church?
It's the State Church of Sweden, which is Lutheran.
Did the congregation accept it well? Did they like it?
As far as I know, they love it. They actually were in on it from the very beginning. So, what really makes me wonder is how the effect is phenomenal, and I think using the space, there would be no hesitation about loving being there. What really I'm impressed with is the leap of faith it took to actually agree to this thing, just looking at drawings and even the model. Because I think it would have been really hard for someone to imagine the power that this kind of space might have just by looking at drawings of it.
How did they construct the brick vaults? Did they build a frame underneath the and then remove the?
Yeah, I'm sure they had to. Let me go back a sec. There's really not much vaulting. When you really look at it, the vaults are actually quite small because, as I said, there's actually a steel member here and here. So they're almost like half vaults.
I see. Okay.
But I'm sure they had to erect some kind of scaffolding. And that's why, I'm sure that's why the radius remains the same, is that scaffolding could probably move along as they were doing the work. Because you can see that the way that it's laid is kind of this way. It's almost like horses running up this way. So I'm sure it was kind of laid in a consecutive fashion, and the formwork probably moved.
Peter, is there a history of underground building in Sweden?
There's a history of burying Vikings,
yeah.
Viking kings. I don't think there's a history of underground buildings.
So this may be translated from a different... You compared it to a catacomb or something.
Yeah, I think this may have been translated from a different tradition, or as I said, Leverance was kind of after this amazingly powerful space, and in order to do it, he had to figuratively put it underground, I think.
But that slot there. What was that slot? What a baptism.
It's just where the water is.
They dumped it.
No, the water, the spigot drips into the shell, and then from the low scallop here, it drips down into that chasm, and that's where it makes the drip, drip, dripping noise. And again, you know, it's like the other sort of cave-like thing. Whenever you're in a cave, you think of sort of water seeping around everywhere, and so it reinforces that notion.
Peter, it's interesting to me that the one on the sticks that you showed, the transport, was from being in the clouds. And
yeah.
This is the opposite.
Well, I would love to have a theologian, you know, study each of these buildings carefully, because the difference between the chapel that I showed you on Tuesday, which was, you know, in heaven, to this, which is kind of, you're preparing for that resurrection, but this is kind of a Good Friday church. You know, this is where you would want to go to Good Friday services, because you really are right there, I think.
Have you ever been to the Crystal Cathedral, and could you compare them?
I don't think I could. I've not been to the Crystal Cathedral. I've seen pictures of it, but again, that's what's so interesting about it. The building that I'm going to show you tomorrow is a new chapel that's been completed in Seattle, at Seattle University, that's all about light. And it's got white stucco walls and the way the light hits the walls. And so, that's actually what I would love to hear someone who's knowledgeable talk about, is the sort of theological implications of different kinds of worship space. And there's obviously a very different kind of mood that's created here. I think much more personal, I think much more contemplative, perhaps, than, you know, some of the light-filled spaces, which seem more accommodating to sort of a larger community of people, and really feeling like you're among a lot of people rather than almost more of a contemplative, personal, spiritual journey, if you will. Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And as I said, I've got another nice project to show you that you could actually visit if you go to Seattle tomorrow. Thanks.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks so much.
Do they reuse the water? I bet it is pumped. I bet there's some kind of little recirculating pump, like a goldfish pump.
What's the name of this one, Peter?
It's St. Petri, Peter, architecture is something that you really have to go.
What are we gonna eat?
You know, I think that you would be. But I think you would be.
Late tonight? You know that I've been on eater.
Yeah.
But
I'm
all hungry. I
don't
need
6 minutes.
Is that true?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, I know. I didn't go to the service. I wasn't there on the Sunday.
Chicken.
That's what I really like.
That's good.
Yeah.
Visiting it by myself.
We lived there. So
there's a chapel
there. That would be where
you
dinner.
Yeah.
It's
amazingly
powerful. There's a chapel there. Who's like,
Reverend
Sutton. He's famous. I can't. Second.
St. Mark's
is
beautiful.
I think St. Mark's is beautiful.
It's near Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Grandiose plans, this huge church. And they never really got beyond the transept. So it's more of a central plan church now, and it's concrete because it was built in the early 20th century. But it was always going to be clad in something, and they never had the money for that. But now that it's just concrete, I think people really love it. They don't love the power of that space.
I was buried in the chapel.
Oh, you were?
It's tough.
Are you a Seattle native?
Yeah, I was born right in Seattle.
You should go, when you get back, go to Seattle University in the chapel.
I was right there a few weeks ago, and we wanted to go in, but it was something private.
But you read about the paper and stuff.
No, I haven't. Okay. I'm actually getting it home.
Okay. It's fabulous. It's really one of the nicest pieces of architecture in Seattle. I tell all my students to go there. It's such an interesting contrast to this because it's all about light.
Decorating.